As tanks rolled into the city, army snipers took to the rooftops. Families out to collect their morning bread were shot dead. The siege of Hama was over. The time had come for a concerted effort by President Assad's forces to crush the uprising on the eve of Ramadan.
By mid-July of 2011, the largest protests to take place in Syria are being followed up by the largest massacres to take place thus far. This is something seen from the smallest villages to the biggest cities, even in places like Latakia and Damascus, those exceptionally dangerous places for protesters that we've mentioned before. For more on this, we turn again to We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled by Dr. Wendy Perlman. Here, she quotes Hadi, a shopkeeper from the rural Latakia province. Quote, "In our village in Latakia, it started with graffiti. People went out at night and wrote on the walls in complete secrecy. We called them night bats. We'd wake up in the morning and see slogans like, 'The people want to overthrow the regime. Ashab yurid iskat an-nizam.' Later, the phase of night chanting began. Electricity was cut daily at 7 in the evening, so there were no lights. In the darkness, people would shout from their windows, 'God is great, Allahu Akbar.' You'd hear voices coming from all directions. The security forces would arrive, and everybody would go quiet. Then the security forces would leave, and everyone would start again." Unquote. That was Hadi, a shop owner from rural Latakia, quoted by Dr. Wendy Perlman in her book, We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled. Again, Latakia is part of what people call the Alawi heartland. This is the region where the Assad family comes from. The reason why this is important is because it should not be happening. From the regime's point of view, they should not be seeing protests in the Alawi heartland like Latakia, or the economic hub, Aleppo, or the capital city, Damascus. And yet, even in places that are considered regime strongholds and will be considered regime strongholds in the years of war to come, even those places are seeing major protests against the regime. And even in Damascus, they're starting to see more and more serious unrest. Mike Giglio writes about this in his book, Shatter the Nations. Here he describes what life was like in Damascus in this time. Quote, "At first, central Damascus had been mostly isolated from the unrest, but Leo could feel it creeping toward him. Neighbors and friends were sucked into the conflict. A salesman who worked in a shop that sold designer shoes was arrested at a protest, and when he emerged weeks later, he was marked by torture and filled with rage. A seller of hairstyling products who'd been giving food and blankets to protesters simply disappeared from his shop one day. There were whispers that he'd been betrayed by another of Leo's friends, a chef who backed the regime. A screenwriter was arrested. He had been speaking against Assad in the cafes, and he too was never heard from again. Three brothers who worked as wedding planners became members of the Shabiha, the pro-regime death squads, the locals called ghosts. All across Syria, military personnel were defecting rather than obey orders to fire on the crowds, while bands of civilians, like the former shoe salesman, armed themselves." Unquote. That was Mike Giglio writing in his book, Shatter the Nations. And this perception the regime has that this stuff should not be happening here, it gets seriously reinforced on Wednesday, July 13th. Now, okay, we always say that the biggest protests take place on Fridays. That's still true, but this is one of the major protests that didn't happen on a Friday. On Wednesday, July 13th, 2011, there were protests organized by urban intellectuals in Damascus's middle-class El Midan neighborhood. Now, this area is kind of a conservative Sunni Muslim area, but it is very urban. It is very middle class. The people who live in this neighborhood do not fit the mold, the stereotype of your typical protester in Syria. These are not working class people from Homs or farmers from Dara. These are middle class, sophisticated people. These are college professors. These are artists. These are filmmakers. Basel Shahada, we've talked about him in previous episodes. He was present at this protest. I might be a little off when I say this. Al Midan, as far as I know, is located pretty close to the center of Damascus. I got a friend from that neighborhood. He's probably going to hit me up on Twitter and tell me how wrong I was. But Al Midan is not an area that has seen protesting thus far, but it will see more protests going forward, as my buddy from Al Midan told me. You can hear about that in our episodes, Damascus to DC. And unfortunately, though, a lot of these intellectuals who rallied together all these people in Al Midan and really, really terrified the regime that random Wednesday, a lot of them got arrested. A lot of those people, including Basel Shahada, ended up being detained and tortured. In Basel Shahada's case, one story I heard was that he was actually suffering from diabetes at the time. He was denied insulin and other care while he was imprisoned. But of course, Fridays are always the days where we see the largest protests. And Friday, July 15th, 2011, sees massive protests all over the country calling for the release of 12,000 prisoners detained since March. This Friday of the freedom of the hostages or freedom of prisoners sees hundreds of thousands of people protest in Hama alone. 700,000 people gathered in Hama. 350,000 gathered in Deir ez-Zor, 20,000 in Aleppo of all places. One of those places where protests should not be happening is now seeing protesters gather in the tens of thousands. And also, as we mentioned earlier in the episode, we're seeing more and more protests take place at Syrian embassies all over the world, organized by members of the Syrian diaspora. And you'd really think that by now the regime would have figured out that just doing the same thing over and over and over again, arresting people, killing people, torturing people over and over and over again, you'd think that by now they'd realize, oh, we keep on doing this and it either A, is not solving the problem, or actually, as we see what's happening right now, it's making the problem worse. There's more protesters than ever now. You'd think that by now they would have figured out what they're doing wasn't very effective, but no, they kept on trying to do these same things and it doesn't work. They are not instilling fear. They started off months back firing warning shots, and then people kept protesting. Then they started shooting people, and people kept protesting. Now they're spraying people with automatic fire, and people keep protesting. Now they're using automatic gunfire and artillery shells and tanks, and people are not only continuing to protest, the crowds are getting larger and more widespread. All over the country, pretty much every province at this point, every major city at this point, is seeing large-scale protesting. I mean, 700,000 in Hama alone. Let's see, 700,000 in Hama, plus 350,000 in Deir ez-Zor, that's over a million. Plus all the other tens of thousands all over the country, adding up to maybe another 100,000 or maybe 200,000. The number of protesters now on any given Friday by July of 2011, it's in the millions. And I want to take a moment to reiterate that the vast majority of these protesters are peaceful protesters. The vast majority of these protesters are people who go out holding signs, chanting slogans like Ashab Yarid, Iskat an-Nizam, the people want the fall of the regime, or Allah Syria, Horeya Wabas, God Syria, freedom and nothing else. What's significant about this is how many people are there. The fact that you have city squares where protesters are packed together like sardines. That's how big these crowds are. Even the biggest, most open city squares are now getting overcrowded with protesters gathering to chant together, to sing together, and to vent their grievances together. Why is this a big deal for the regime? Why is it that peaceful protesting is such a big deal for them? Well, not only in Syria, but in a lot of countries, there have been a lot of revolutions, both successful and unsuccessful, that happened that way. And what happens in these situations, I'm going to use a morbid metaphor because a hell of a lot of stuff we talk about on this show is very morbid, so it fits. Here's a morbid metaphor. These protests are kind of like, they're sort of like a old-timey torture method that's no longer used. Even the most brutal regimes and terrorist organizations don't really do this anymore. You saw this a lot in like 1600s Europe and European colonies in the Americas. First, they would have a board placed on top of them, and then they would start to put rocks on top of the board. This is a really slow, horrible way to kill somebody. Just one rock after another, and just the weight just gets slowly built up, rock after rock after rock, and eventually gets to the point where the weight of all those rocks on that board is just so much that it crushes the victim to death. It was one of the things that Puritan colonists in North America would do during witch hunt hysterias, like the Salem witch trials. So imagine one of those people in the 1600s being held down under that board as another crowd of people adds one large rock after another. That right there is a great way to describe how the protests in Syria are affecting the regime by July of 2011. You have a lot of protests going on in a lot of different places all over the country. And as a result, the weight is getting really, really heavy. And people in the regime know that if things keep going on unabated, if this pattern is not interrupted somehow, if things keep going in this direction over a long enough period of time, the regime's spine will break. The next day, Saturday, July 16th, sees a really strange incident take place in the eastern border town Abu Kamal, or Abu Kamal, depending on who you ask. We don't know exactly what happened because of conflicting accounts and lack of really hard evidence. We don't really have any pictures or videos taken, unlike most other instances we've talked about in the show. So we don't know exactly what happened on Saturday, July 16th in Abu Kamal, but eventually protesters somehow got their hands on a bunch of weapons and several armored vehicles. Those may have been given to them by soldiers defecting from the regime, people who were disgusted by the continual slaughter of their fellow citizens. Or it's also possible and alleged by some sources that these protesters rioted and attacked security forces and took all that stuff by force. Ultimately, though, after negotiations with the regime, the residents of Abu Kamal gave all the stuff back to the Syrian military. I really wish there was more solid information available about what happened. It stood out to me when I first came across it, just really for how strange it sounds. It's weird compared to what we've heard about happening in other parts of Syria. And I guess maybe it goes to show that maybe there's some kind of cultural difference in eastern Syria. Maybe protesters and the regime have a slightly different relationship there. I need to get more people on from that region of Syria. I need to get more of them on the show. The day after all of that, on July 17th, 2011, Homs made international headlines when 30 people were killed. Not by the regime, because at this point the regime regularly kills that many people or more in instances of mass murder. These 30 people in Homs were killed by what people have described as factional fighting. This is the first documented instance of street fights and other forms of violence occurring between two different groups of civilians, those who support the regime versus those who support the opposition. And I gotta say, I mean, I know most people listening to this by now, most of y'all realize that I'm very sympathetic to the Syrian opposition. But this particular instance we're about to talk about was not merely an example of pro-regime civilians attacking pro-opposition civilians. This was gang warfare, where both sides did some pretty messed up things. I'm going to quote now a Reuters article written about that day by Mariam Karouni and Oliver Holmes. Quote, Rami Abdulrahman, head of the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, said on Monday that clashes between pro- and anti-Assad residents started that weekend after the bodies of kidnapped Assad supporters were returned to their relatives, dismembered. Unquote. Now, keep in mind, the opposition has been getting that exact treatment from the regime for months. I'm not condoning opposition supporters kidnapping, murdering, and dismembering people, and then dumping their bodies on their family's doorstep. I do not condone that or support that, but we got to keep in mind, they weren't the first ones to do that. It's been going on for a while. This is the first documented case I've seen where individuals who supported the opposition returned the favor. Now back to the quote. Quote, Homs has been the focal point of the uprising since the military stormed it 2 months ago to try to crush street protests calling for Assad to quit after 11 years in power. At least 30 civilians were killed. They fell after civil fighting between pro- and anti-regime residents started on Saturday, the observatory said in a statement. They went on to say, these clashes are a dangerous development that undermines the revolution and serves the interests of its enemies who want to turn it into a civil war. Mohamed Saleh, an activist and resident of Homs, said that there was no more fighting on Monday, but residents were tense. He said a group of Alawite men, including four policemen, went missing on Thursday. The bodies of four of them were found on Saturday with their eyes gouged out. Six more were found on Sunday. Immediately, some people in their neighborhood went to the street and torched, robbed, and destroyed at least 12 shops belonging to Sunnis, Saleh told Reuters by telephone. The security forces were watching and did nothing. I saw that. Then shooting started, and we did not know where it was coming from, and people started dying on both sides. Saleh said that residents of Homs blame Sunni and Alawi thugs for the violence. This is very dangerous. We are trying to calm things down. Nobody in Homs accepts this. The people do not want these sectarian divisions. That was an article written for Reuters by Mariam Karouni and Oliver Holmes. What we just described is something that you will see mentioned frequently by the pro-Assad side. You will often see people point to this and similar instances that took place in Homs as proof that the revolution was somehow a jihadist plot all along. But that's not the reality of what happened. Mohamed Saleh did a pretty good job summarizing it when he described it as Sunni thugs versus Alawi thugs. That is pretty much what happened. These thugs who supported the Syrian opposition were a minority within the movement. And this minority almost certainly included a certain number of the extremists that Assad had recently released specifically to taint the opposition with extremists. So if you're ever on Twitter and you see somebody point to a quote from some pro-Assad figure where they describe something like security forces being murdered and dismembered in Homs, these protesters are so violent and vile. When they try to use that incident in Homs to smear the movement as a whole, keep this in mind. When it comes to Homs in particular, for a variety of reasons, ranging from their recent history to the fact that it is a vastly majority Sunni city ruled by a smaller than usual Alawi minority, and several other complicated socio-political reasons. Because of all those different factors, the situation in Homs became a hell of a lot more violent, a hell of a lot more quickly than elsewhere in Syria. I very recently, just because I enjoy torturing myself, read this really long article written by a Assad-supporting libertarian. He's not even Syrian. He's just an American guy who doesn't even know anything about the country, which is typical for Assadists in the West. He wrote this like 10,000-word essay about why the Syrian revolution was secretly an Al-Qaeda CIA plot. And then he spent like 90% of the frickin' essay talking about things completely unrelated to Syria and the Syrian revolution. And finally, at the very end of the damn essay, when he finally starts talking about events in Syria in 2011, one of the things he pointed to was what we just talked about, the violence in Homs. And this guy was basically saying, look at this, look at this. These people are so violent. These aren't peaceful protesters. Look at this, look at this. They're so violent. In Homs, a small number of them were violent in mid-2011. That is the reality. That was not representative of the movement as a whole. It was not representative of a majority of the Syrian opposition in July of 2011. But honestly, when I read that essay, God, calling it an essay or an article is honestly too dignified. It was just a conspiracy theory blog post is what it was. But when I was reading it, when I saw him mention Homs, I was like, Homs. Yep. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that area became a lot more violent a lot more quickly than most other places. But that context gets left out. And the whole point of this podcast is to counteract people like that guy with his bullshit article about Al-Qaeda and the CIA being the puppet masters of the Syrian revolution. But seriously, though, what we are seeing in July of 2011 in Homs, even though this is not representative of the Syrian opposition as a whole, it is a significant development to see the first real instance of communal violence in the Syrian civil war. It's a big deal to see civilians from both camps fighting each other in the streets and then rioting in each other's neighborhoods. That is a significant development. Other members of the Syrian opposition are looking at that and they're going, dude, what the hell are y'all doing? That's so counterproductive. No, don't do that. Don't do that. Unfortunately, the people who spoke out against that, the people in the opposition who condemned what happened in Homs, who condemned violence against Alawi civilians, their influence in the movement is going to shrink as the situation becomes more and more militarized. That's going to be the subject of multiple episodes going forward, but we are just about getting to the very beginning of that in just like minutes from now. This nascent communal violence taking place between Sunnis and Alawis is in large part a result of the regime's divide and conquer strategy that it's been using against the Syrian opposition. When different groups within the opposition are busy fighting each other, that will help the regime regain the upper hand. For more on the increasing violence between the Alawi and Sunni communities, we turn again to A Woman in the Crossfire, Diaries of the Syrian Revolution by Samar Yazbek. Quote, even though some of the Sunni and Alawi notables were trying to staunch the crisis, the escalation was an obvious consequence of the rumors. Alawite and Sunni clerics walked arm in arm in a joint procession against sectarianism and arrived together at the Al-Hassan Mosque in the Al-Amara neighborhood. Unquote. I should say real quick, this is happening in a city called Jabla. Now back to the quote. A delegation from the Sunni community went to a memorial ceremony in the villages of Zama and Harf Matar, and the imam from the Sunni mosque went along as part of the delegation. People from both communities were trying to mitigate sectarian strife, but the next day, rumors would spread that stirred it back up again, making up stories about Sunni men raping Alawite women and then spreading them among the Alawite villages. Of course, nobody knew who was actually behind the rumors. They would materialize like ghosts, then become unimpeachable. Rumors were the main source of information for many Alawites because the internet had been blocked for the most part inside of Jabla. Thus, Al-Dunya station and Syrian television were the only news sources. Someone wanted to ratchet up the sectarian tension, and within 2 days of the massacre, people had become convinced the army presence was necessary in order to protect the Alawites from the Sunnis. Even some of the Sunnis were convinced by that narrative. During that time, supporters of the Assad family were present in Jabla and making daily visits. We heard rumors that the demonstrators were hitting the army with dynamite and small arms, and that the tension between the Alawites and the Sunnis was intermittent. But the spread of rumors wouldn't stop. The demonstrators started going out every day, and all we heard about their demonstrations was how they wanted to attack and curse the Alawites, how they were calling for them to be killed. The security forces and the Baathists kept distributing leaflets in the village along the names of people from Jabla who were wanted. The leaflets said they were armed men, and they included both their names and their mothers' names. The security forces passed out leaflets in which they claimed to have captured 3 Israeli officers, explaining that this was the reason why the army had to move in and open fire. Then, a wild rumor that frightened the Alawites spread, saying that there were 10 Sunni militiamen with heavy weaponry heading for the Alawite-majority Jabla suburbs. Alawite shopkeepers would close up their stores in fear at 4 or 5 in the afternoon, even as two Alawite notables then opened their own shops and went back to work. The Sunni stores were all closed, and from then on, it became a tradition for Alawites to boycott Sunni businesses, and Alawites who wanted to shop in Sunni stores soon became afraid of the other Alawites. I remember Jabla, and I remember the Sunni majority square. We never thought about the fact that they were Sunnis. We bought from them anyway. The people from the village had all the purchasing power. What united those businessmen with the Alawites was mutual interest and need. I never dreamed that things would become this strained between them. After these incidents, the number of armed Alawites grew. Suddenly, you would see weapons in the villages. When the security forces saw Alawites carrying weapons, they would look the other way. Meanwhile, the security forces would expose Sunni men, including doctors and other upright and honest people, just for making humanitarian contributions to those who were wounded during the demonstrations. One time, they handed out leaflets with the name of a dead man, but for the Alawites, these names had become killers and armed men and criminals who wanted to slaughter them, as the security forces and Baathists and the Shabiha claimed in their flyers. They would put the names of real criminals alongside respectable people. They were dead set on drumming up slander and sectarian strife between Sunnis and Alawites by smearing the reputation of Alawite women. This heightened the fear among the people of the Alawite villages. This one time, they spread a rumor in the villages that a pornographic film of a Sunni man with Alawite women was being circulated among the protesters. The incitement reached the most horrible and filthiest point you could imagine. That's something else I forgot to mention. Before the Jabla massacre, the man from the Al-Assad family came to the village of Bustan al-Basha and started handing out weapons to people for free, but there was a catch. He would take their IDs. In the village of Damashko outside of Latakia, the same guy showed up and asked people if they needed weapons, but the people kicked him out. Unquote. That was Samar Yazbek writing in her book, A Woman in the Crossfire, Diaries of the Syrian Revolution. The regime's multi-pronged counteroffensive against the Syrian Revolution is beginning to take its course. That idea that I've mentioned of tainting the opposition with extremism, it's already begun. We're starting to see it. We see it in these attacks on Alawite civilians. And yes, as Samar Yazbek noted, a lot of the reports of atrocities committed against Alawites in 2011, a lot of those reports and claims and rumors were completely baseless. It's about like 90% BS, maybe 10% or less true. For every one riot or hate crime committed by Sunnis against Alawites, for every one of those, you've got about 90 or 100 rumors and false accusations. For every one extremist, you've got about 10 different lies from the regime. And this isn't limited to just propaganda either, or at least not just content. It's not limited to just radio and TV and rhetoric. Physical force is also used in this psychological warfare campaign. Rabin Yasin Kassab and Leila Al-Shami write about this in their book, Burning Country. Quote, "From the very start, the regime resorted to a campaign of rumors and false flag operations to divide Sunnis from Alawis on the Syrian coast, the home region of top regime figures and at least half of the total Alawi community." Unquote. So the words Alawite and Alawi are kind of used interchangeably. Alawi, I'm pretty sure that's closer to what people actually say in Syria. But I've noticed that sometimes when I use the word Alawi when I'm talking to Syrians, they make a point to say Alawite. I hope I didn't accidentally insult them by saying Alawi. I didn't mean to imply that their English wasn't good enough. So whenever I'm talking to somebody from Syria, you know, if they say Alawite, I will say Alawite. If they say Alawi, I'll say Alawi. I don't mean to alienate them. When I read these sources, sometimes, you know, Samar Yazbek, she's Syrian. She's also an Alawi, and she wrote Alawite in her book, or at least in the English translation. In Burning Country, they write Alawi, so I'm just going to say Alawi. Sorry, I didn't clear that up earlier. I'm just going to start the quote over again. Quote, "From the very start, the regime resorted to a campaign of rumors and false flag operations to divide Sunnis from Alawis on the Syrian coast, the home region of top regime figures and at least half the total Alawi community. In March, armed gangs were unleashed on the port city of Latakia. They drove around shooting from their cars, screaming threats of rape and murder. In the Sunni areas, they declared themselves as vengeful Alawis. In Alawi areas, they posed as vengeful Sunnis. These thugs were Shabiha, a term with several etymologies, but certainly connected to the words Shaba, meaning ghost, after the Mercedes ghost, a car popular with the macabre. Before 2011, Shabiha used to refer to the smuggling gangs based in the Alawi Mountains who worked for lesser members of the Assad family. During the revolution, the term came to refer to the sub-state thug militias financed by Rami Makhlouf and other pro-regime businessmen, to whom much of the repression was subcontracted. Later on, revolutionaries and rebel fighters would attach the label pejoratively to anyone fighting for Assad. In most of the country, the Shabiha comprised of paid goons from all backgrounds. In some regions, however, they had an exclusively Alawi or Shia composition. The massacres committed by these men at a later stage would play a key role in sectarianizing the conflict. But the most basic and frequently used weapon in the regime's arsenal could be named shock and awe. On June 3rd, 2011, the UN reported that 1,000 people had died in the first 3 months of the uprising. Nearly 3,000 at a very minimum had been detained. More horrifying than the actual numbers were the details. Increasingly, the corpses of activists and protesters were returned to their families bearing the marks of torture. Children were not spared. Videos were either smuggled out or deliberately leaked of macabre agents taunting, whipping, and electrocuting even primary school-aged children. The horror was not evenly applied. Kurds in the northeast were rarely met by bullets, and demonstrations in central Damascus were dispersed by clubs and tear gas rather than live fire. The sons and daughters of the rich and areas with large minority populations were treated more gently. In the years to come, this pattern would greatly contribute to Sunni resentment." Unquote. That was an excerpt from Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War by Robin Yasin Kassab and Leila Al-Shami. So in July of 2011, you got all this psychological warfare stuff going on, in addition to the regime machine-gunning protesters in the streets day after day after day. You've got all this killing, all this propaganda, all this fear-mongering, all these attempts to terrorize the population, whether it be an attempt to cow the opposition with fear or an attempt to radicalize their supporters into violent action. And what is the grand result? The protests keep getting bigger. On Friday, July 22nd, 2011, multiple cities across Syria see hundreds of thousands of people take part in the protests. This leads to an estimated grand total of 7 million people protesting in Syria in a single day. 7 million people. Keep in mind, Syria's total population in 2011 is an estimated 21 million. So if the 7 million people protesting estimate is correct, that means that on July 22nd, 2011, a third of Syria's entire population came out to protest against the Assad regime. A third of the country's population. Imagine a third of your country coming out to protest anything. What happened in the U.S. in 2020? That was like, what, 10% of our population? The protests were big, but that was not anywhere near a third of the population. If a third of the entire population is among those willing to openly oppose the regime, what percentage of the population is quietly opposed? It's very rare for everybody who opposes the regime to come out and protest. There are a lot of silent supporters. So if a third of the entire population is willing to loudly and openly support the ousting of Assad, how many people do you think are silently supporting them at home? So this day, the Friday of Khalid ibn al-Walid's grandsons. That name has a lot of Syrian history and culture behind it. You know how we've said that Homs at this point has become the epicenter of the revolution? Khalid ibn al-Walid was a really important figure in early Islamic history. Frankly, he was one of the best generals in all of military history. And he also happens to be buried in Homs. He played a very big role in Islam being introduced to Syria when they conquered that region from the Byzantine Empire. So for Syria's Sunni Muslim population, especially for people in Homs, his burial place, Khalid ibn al-Walid is a very important historical figure for them. He's almost like a George Washington figure, or maybe more like Richard the Lionheart figure, given how long ago he lived. So on this day, July 22nd, 2011, the Friday of Khalid ibn al-Walid's grandsons, the grandsons referring to Syria's population. I know this probably sounds very Sunni-centric, but it wasn't. You don't get a third of the population when it's only Sunnis protesting. This day saw people from all walks of life, all religions, all of Syria's ethnic groups, whether they be Arabs or Kurds or Syrian Turkmen or Assyrians or others. Yeah, I said Assyrian starting with an A. They've been around since the days of ancient Assyria thousands of years ago. That's also where the word Syria comes from. And perhaps most importantly, you have people from every single socioeconomic class taking part in the protests. As Robin Yasin Kassab and Leila Al-Shami pointed out in their book, the children of rich people got relatively lenient treatment compared to people from working class or middle class backgrounds. So what we see is that you have working class people, middle class people, and upper class people joining together. We see working class Sunnis in Homs protesting at the same time as middle class Alawi and Christian intellectuals in Damascus. Remember that metaphor I brought up earlier about the regime's kind of in a similar position of somebody being pressed to death, as it's called? You know, you put someone on the ground, you put a board on top of them, and then you just start loading up that board with rocks, that really horrendous torture method from the Middle Ages and early modern era. Well, the regime's got a lot of rocks stacked on them. And now on this day, I know we say this over and over again, largest protest to take place thus far meaning an entire third of the country's population, that rock pile is now as big as it's ever been. And people within the regime know that over a long enough timeline, this will cause the regime to collapse. They cannot bear this much weight for very much longer. That is the impact that peaceful protest can have in a country, even one ruled by a horrendous totalitarian dictatorship. The regime is going to respond to these larger than ever protests with more violence than ever. It's also going to deploy all of its resources to engage in a nationwide manhunt for every activist and protester they can get their hands on. Keep in mind, this is right after they released a whole bunch of legit terrorists from various prisons. Now that they've let a whole bunch of terrorists out of prison, now they are engaging in a major crackdown against the protesters. Wendy Perlman writes a little bit about this time in her book, We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled. Here, she quotes Mahmoud, an actor from Homs. In the beginning, people were afraid to talk on the phone, so they'd speak in code. Hey mom, what's new? My God, today it's raining and foggy. Foggy meant security forces were present. Raining meant they were shooting. Storms meant shelling. I was too scared to protest. I went only once because my girlfriend wanted to go. In the taxi and then at the demonstration, I thought everyone else was a security agent about to arrest me. A guy I know got arrested that way. They brought him in for interrogation, but he wouldn't confess that he'd been to a protest. So they showed him a video and asked him, "If you didn't go, who is this?" He turned yellow. In the video, he was in the middle of a demonstration, sitting on someone's shoulders, and that someone turned out to be the interrogator. Unquote. That was Mahmoud, an actor from Homs, quoted by Dr. Wendy Perlman in her book, We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled. I wanted to share that quote because of that part of the beginning where that guy describes talking to his mom over the phone in code. That's one of the realities of being a dissident in a totalitarian state where dissent can get you killed. They have to do this because by July of 2011, the regime is starting to send tanks into neighborhoods known for anti-regime activity, and this includes some of the suburbs surrounding the capital city, Damascus. The following week, from July 22nd to July 29th, 2011, sees more protests, more killings in the streets, more house raids at night, more mass arrests and mass torture. All the things we've been talking about keep going on, but this time on a larger scale. The scale just keeps getting larger and larger. The death toll gets higher and higher. The suffering becomes more and more widespread. But even then, those who oppose the Assad regime still have not given up on their idea, their dream, their goal of a free Syria. As always, Friday sees the largest protests take place, and we see this again on Friday, July 29th. Even with all this going on, you still see massive protests take place on July 29th. By now, what do we mean when we say massive? We're not just talking about hundreds of thousands of people. We're talking about millions of people all across the country protesting. This day was named by activist, "The Friday of Your Silence is Killing Us." This was an appeal to those who had stayed silent thus far, whether they be in Syria or whether they be the international community. The fact is, silence is complicity. And that silence made the world, in a sense, complicit with the Assad regime's bloody, brutal campaign against the opposition. And we see this take place on this Friday. By now, the regime has caught wise to the fact that Friday sees the largest protests. So this week, while they were killing people and arresting people all over the country all week long, they were also getting ready for a major offensive on Friday, July 29th. So in cities all across the country, including Deir ez-Zor, Latakia, Hama, Homs, Qamishli, Aleppo, cities all over the country, as well as Damascus, you see various forms of state violence take place. In some places, tanks and soldiers fire on protesters with live ammunition. In Damascus, because it's a capital city, it's a little less heavy-handed, but you still see mass arrests take place, the largest thus far in Damascus. This is one of the most brutal government offensives to take place against the protesters this entire month. Something else also happens on July 29th, 2011. A major, major development in this story that will have consequences going forward for the next decade. On this day, we see the debut of the Free Syrian Army. Yep, that's right, ladies and gentlemen, we now at last have the grand entrance of the FSA, also known among Syrians as the Free Army. That's right. We've had episode after episode talking about all the protests, and we're going to talk about protests in a lot of the future episodes, but y'all, the FSA, the Free Syrian Army's in the house now. Specifically, on this day, a former SAA colonel named Riyad al-Assad, no relation to Bashar al-Assad, announced the creation of the Free Syrian Army in a video he filmed with other officers who had defected from the Syrian military. I'm sure almost everybody listening to this has at some point come across the term Free Syrian Army or FSA. But what exactly are they? Or at least, what were they? For more on that, I want to turn to a different source. This is an excerpt from Dr. David Lesh's book, Syria. Quote, "In response to the regime's violence against protesters, the Free Syrian Army was formed in the summer of 2011, an amalgam of soldiers who had defected from Syrian armed forces and others seeking an organizational body to coordinate opposition military efforts. Outside of the country, political opposition groups comprised mostly of Syrian exiles established the Syrian National Council, SNC, a civilian body that attempted to become the internationally recognized opposition to the Assad regime. Neither the FSA nor the SNC developed anything close to what their supporters had envisioned. The former, due to fragmentation, lack of coordination, and a dearth of military hardware. And the latter due to the fact that it lacked any legitimacy inside the country from the armed opposition groups who were doing the fighting and dying. One of the primary problems of the Syrian conflict early on became evident in these two attempts to form viable opposition bodies, namely that various elements in which were supported by different outside players, such as Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey, who often had different agendas in terms of who they wanted to support and by what means they wanted to counter the Assad regime. By the late summer and fall of 2011, when many countries, including the United States, demanded that Bashar al-Assad step down as president, the conflict had become a proxy war. On one side, in support of the Syrian government, were Russia, Iran, Hezbollah, and increasingly Iraq. The main players arrayed against the Syrian regime, ostensibly in support of various Syrian opposition groups, were the United States, its European allies, as well as Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar. While the violence and death toll increased, along with the number of Syrian refugees crossing the borders into Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan, the United Nations worked arduously for a ceasefire." Unquote. That was from Dr. David Lesh's book, Syria. I thought it was important to give context about the FSA and bring in an academic text because while a nerd, I'm still a layman. I can't explain it as well as Dr. David Lesh. So I figured it was worth it despite the fact that we went way ahead in terms of the timeline with that quote. And we're going to talk about a lot of the things mentioned there in future episodes. But if nothing else, I want you to take away that the FSA was never just one thing. It was never just one unified body. It was an idea. It was a banner that different people in different parts of Syria could rally around. And unfortunately, we will see not only many, many different FSA groups, there will be many, many different types of FSA groups who oftentimes come into conflict with each other for one reason or another. But we're not there yet. In July of 2011. We're like a year or two away from that. Instead, on July 22nd, 2011, the day that Colonel Riyad al-Assad, no relation to Bashar, announces the creation of the Free Syrian Army, on that day, in that same exact statement, they issue a final warning to the regime that, and I'm paraphrasing here, security forces who kill civilians and besiege cities will be treated as legitimate targets. This is not the first time we've seen armed opposition in Syria. A few episodes ago, we saw the fighting in Jisr al-Shagur. But this is the first attempt to create an organized armed opposition. So rather than small localized pockets of resistance, they're trying to create a nationwide insurgency, one that will end up having mixed results. And it's worth looking at the element of deterrence here. We can see that rather than just immediately going on the offensive, the creators of the FSA, whether or not they were even in a position to deliver, they start off by presenting Bashar al-Assad an out. He doesn't even need to step down. He just needs to stop killing civilians and besieging cities. Unfortunately, though, doing so will just increase the pressure that's on the regime. Doing so will lead to an escalation of protests. So going back to our pressing someone to death metaphor, you've got the regime underneath that board with all the rocks on top. If they stop, killing civilians and besieging cities, you'll see more protests, meaning more rocks will be added to the pile of rocks on top of the regime's spine. I'm not saying that to defend the Assad regime. I'm saying that as a potential explanation for why the regime would just shrugging off this last warning. We should also take a minute to look over how did protesters in Syria feel about the emergence of the FSA and other armed opposition. For more on this, we turn again to The Impossible Revolution by Yassin Alhaj Saleh. Quote, "The emergence of the revolution's military component was certainly not anyone's first choice, nor was it the application of a ready-made ideology of militant action. Rather, the military component emerged primarily as a byproduct of the regime's militarized confrontations with the popular protests from the outset. As this reaction grew, it gradually began to draw justification from ideologies already available to Syrians, including the idea of jihad. But the strongest and most legitimate justifications have always been self-defense and the protection of civilians from regime brutality. The first phase reached a crescendo during the mass demonstrations in Hama and Deir ez-Zor, which were similar to protests in Egypt's Tahrir Square. The regime hesitated in confronting the protesters, particularly in Hama, perhaps because of its status in the Syrian national conscience as a city that lost something like 30,000 of its inhabitants in the massacre of February 1982. The American and French ambassadors also arranged to visit Hama on Friday, July 7, 2011, which provided the city with some level of protection. However, the regime then occupied the city with tanks at the beginning of Ramadan in early August and did the same in Deir ez-Zor, Homs, Idlib, and some areas of Damascus, not to mention Dara, the cradle of the revolution. These occupations were accompanied by exceptional forms of torture, and in many cases death under torture, of the sort that Syrians thought they had bid farewell to by the end of the 1980s. During the first phase of the revolution, there was an average of 20 casualties per day." Unquote. That was from Yassin Alhaj Saleh, writing in his book, The Impossible Revolution, Making Sense of the Syrian Tragedy. Well, there I just went and spoiled how the episode ends with that quote. We'll get to that in a few minutes. Before we get into that, I want to turn back to something I hinted at earlier. I said that the nascent Free Syrian Army had issued one last warning to the Assad regime to stop what they're doing. And I said that the regime would ignore that warning. Well, we're there. So to tell this part of the story, I want to enlist the help of Sam Daguer and quote his book, Assad or We Burn the Country. Quote, "The ambassador's visit to Hama bought protesters an almost 20-day reprieve. On July 29th, 2011, hundreds of thousands amassed in the city center. Large banners covered the facades of government buildings around the square. The banners bore slogans addressed to Bashar, Game Over, and Leave, Syria is more beautiful without you. 2 days later, Bashar al-Assad ordered the army to crush the protests and reclaim control of the rebellious city. By then, Bashar had removed his uncooperative and reticent defense minister, Ali Habib, and put him under house arrest. Tanks and armored vehicles thundered into Hama's city center from all directions. A few of the protesters who had taken up arms in the weeks before tried to resist. Others raided the armories of neighborhood police stations and took weapons to try to defend their city, but they were no match for tanks and anti-aircraft guns. Several hundred people, the majority civilians, were killed. Within 5 days, Bashar retook the city that had been passionately chanting for his ouster. There is no god but Bashar, his forces spray-painted on the walls of the city his father had massacred 3 decades earlier." Unquote. That was from Assad or We Burn the Country by Sam Daguer. We've talked about massacres in this show. We've talked about massacres in this episode. We've talked about massacres in previous episodes. But this, the massacre that took place in Hama, starting on July 31st, it went on for several days, but starting on July 31st, 2011, you have a massive, at this point, almost unprecedented massacre take place in Hama. And there are other massacres taking place all over the country on July 31st. This is the eve of Ramadan, the holiest month in Islam. It's very likely that in addition to everything else going on, the regime realized, oh dear God, the holiest month in Islam means you might have even more people joining the protests. You'll have a majority of the population fasting during the day as per the customs of Ramadan. Who knows what that means? Who knows what impact that'll have on the protests? The regime is already close to its breaking point. I've mentioned the pile of rocks. The regime's underneath that board, and you've got that rock pile on top of the board, and they're adding more and more rocks to the pile. The regime probably looked at Ramadan and thought, we're going to see more rocks than ever get added to the grand total starting in Ramadan. So, with all that in mind, we can see why July 31st, 2011 ends up being the deadliest day of the uprising thus far, because the regime is trying to squelch this with as much violence as necessary. For more on this, I want to turn again to Burning Country by Robin Yasin Kassab and Leila Alshami. Quote, the protests were growing exponentially. In July, some of the biggest were in the city of Hama, scene of the Muslim Brotherhood's 1982 armed uprising and of the regime's retaliatory slaughter of between 10 and 20,000 people. Hama had been traumatized for a generation by that episode. The 2011 protests grew more slowly in the city, then more quickly, after dozens of protesters were shot dead. But by July, the army, security forces, police, and even traffic cops had withdrawn, and activists were declaring Hama liberated. Checkpoints and barricades were thrown up to prevent security from re-entering, and the neighborhoods began to organize themselves, directing traffic, allocating drinking water, and collecting waste. Activists distributed leaflets calling on people to shun sectarianism and violence and to avoid damage to property. During these days, no armed gangs emerged from the shadows to terrorize and loot. Christians and Alawis were not rounded up and shot. Nobody was whipped for wearing an un-Islamic haircut. All that happened was that demonstrations day and night swelled into crowds of hundreds of thousands, men and women, adults and children. There was a festival atmosphere of song and dance. U.S. Ambassador Robert Ford traveled to Hama on July 8th and witnessed that day's protest, much to the chagrin of the regime, and of some activists too, who knew that the regime would use the American presence to discredit them. By the end of the month, Hama's governor was replaced and the army returned. Ramadan was coming. Many Syrians hoped increased mosque gatherings in the holy month would finally bring down the regime. On the eve of Ramadan, a new nationwide crackdown saw hundreds killed across the country, at least 100 in Hama alone. Hospitals overcrowded with dead and wounded were beginning to run out of supplies. Unquote. That was from Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War, by Robin Yasin Kassab and Leila Alshami. This episode, this chapter of the story, focused on the zenith of the Syrian revolution, when possibly a third of the entire country's population went out into the streets to protest against the regime. The next episode is going to begin a new chapter in the story, and this new chapter is going to be a lot bloodier, a lot darker. What happened to Syria gets its name because we dive deep into what happened. And what happened in August of 2011 in Syria can only be described as a nationwide massacre. Thank you for listening to What Happened to Syria, a podcast about the country, the people, and their impact on the wider world since 2011. Follow us on Twitter at SyriaPod so you can stay up to date with future episodes. You can also email us at whathappenedtosyriapodcast@gmail.com. We encourage anyone to reach out to us if you think we got a detail wrong or if you have information relevant to the topics we discuss. If you are Syrian, part of the Syrian diaspora, have spent time in Syria at some point in the last 10 years, or have otherwise been personally affected by events in Syria since 2011, please reach out to us. We'd love to have you on the show. Next time, we're going to go over what's at this point the bloodiest and most widespread campaign of massacres across Syria. The Ramadan crackdown in August of 2011, we'll see the regime attempt to finish off the Syrian opposition once and for all, essentially drowning the country in blood. But instead, this will all eventually backfire when it plants the seeds of a war that is still raging to this day. If you like what you heard and want to support future episodes, please consider supporting us on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/whathappenedtosyria to support us for as little as $1 a month. You can access bonus episodes for just $3 a month and join our Discord server for $5. You can also get fan-requested content and a shout-out in each episode when you join as a VIP patron for $20. Our bonus content includes exclusive interviews with people from Syria or experts on the subject matter. This includes people like Masoud, a young man originally from Aleppo, who's come on the show a couple of times to tell us what it was like when his hometown became the scene of Syria's deadliest and most destructive battle.
Like shelling, sniper fire, that was just a normal part of our daily lives.
Shout out to our patrons on Patreon, Jaeger DePato and Evan Kennedy. Thank you to all of our listeners. I'm Sean Hastings, the creator and host of What Happened to Syria.